constantly traveling to Nijmegen took so much time, and so did my translation work, which I needed to pay for Hauer's upkeep and to send money to Ma. The classes in Leiden were small and could be intense. The teachers used to lay out 3 or 4 theories on something abstract. Charismatic leadership, or middle-class support for revolution, or the need for proportional representation, and ask us to analyze whether the data backed up the argument, whether there were gaps, and then form our own theories. If we couldn't develop an alternative theory, they said we were incurious and not fit to become scientists. We had to devise a proper theory with proper methodology. If not, what we said was dismissed as pub talk, not science. We were encouraged to read widely, outside the curriculum. I loved it, but it was hard to keep up with it all. In September 1997, I became eligible for Dutch citizenship. I had been in Holland for 5 years. I could barely wait. In fact, I had registered my application months before. On a practical level, I wanted a Dutch passport so I could travel more easily. It was so difficult to move around as a refugee. I also still thought the authorities might find out I had lied and retract my refugee status. Once I became a Dutch citizen, I thought I would be safe from that. I had been a refugee all my life, since I left Mogadishu when I was 8. Now I wanted to become a real participating member of a living democracy. I wanted to belong. On August 21, 1997, I received a letter. 5 years almost to the day since I had first received my refugee status in Luntren, the Queen of Holland had accepted my application to become Dutch. I would have to wait for 2 weeks to pick up my new passport at Leiden City Council. When I got to the front of the line, my heart was pounding. "I'm here for my naturalization," I told the dumpy blonde woman behind the desk and showed her my letter. She looked up and said, "Okay, you can pay over there." The cashier took my money and handed me something, a Dutch passport. It had my photo in it and my name, Ayan Hirsi Ali, a name that by now had come to seem normal. There was no speech, no lecture of my rights and obligations. Receiving it was the least momentous occasion in the world. Marco and I had a party to celebrate, and I told everyone, "I'm Dutch." Nobody snickered exactly, but they looked at me strangely. It wasn't that I was black and claiming Dutchness. That was fine. It was because being Dutch meant absolutely nothing to these people. If anything, my Dutch friends seemed uncomfortable with the symbols of Dutchness, the flag and the monarchy. These things seemed to them to hark back to the treacherous days of the Second World War. They saw nationalism as almost the same thing as racism. Nobody seemed proud of being Dutch. At first, Hauer seemed to be doing well in Kenya. We spoke on the phone every 10 days or so, and she seemed happy. She even talked about getting a job. Then in October, she clearly became ill again. On the phone, she rambled incoherently, lacing every conversation with religious ravings. She was hearing voices. I suggested that she come back to Leiden, but she said she was afraid of Holland. Then, the next time I called, she said she wanted to come back to Holland, but she had lost her passport. She begged me to come and get her out somehow without one. She said Ma tied her up sometimes, and Ma had beat her. She wailed, "I'm wasting time, I'm getting older, I'm in a mess, I'm pregnant." After that, Hauer never came to the phone again. I spoke only to Ma, who told me Hauer was becoming more violent. Ma knew Hauer was pregnant. When I brought it up, she just said, "Allah has willed it," with bitter resignation. I sent money. At the beginning of December, I called again, and Ma told me Hauer was ill. She said, "If you want to see your sister alive, come now." It was exam time in Leiden, and I didn't take Ma seriously. I thought about going to Nairobi during the Christmas vacation. But I had fallen so far behind with my studies in the months I had been looking after Hauer. I ended up deciding that I must use the holiday break to finish writing several papers. few days after the New Year celebrations, on January 8, 1998, my father called, and it was the worst news of my life. Hawea was taken by Allah to her final destination, he said. She had been sick for a week, then she died. I couldn't believe it. It was as if someone had just sucked all the air out of the room. I burst out crying, and my father said, "No, Ayan, we must not cry for Hawea. From Allah we come and to Allah we return. She's with God. All of us still have to struggle through life on earth to attain what she has. She rests in peace." I just kept on crying. I took the first flight. When I left for the airport, I put on a black coat and a headscarf, the same outfit I had worn when I arrived in Europe. About an hour before I landed in Nairobi, they buried Hawea. I never got to see her body, never got to say goodbye. Muslims must bury people within 24 hours. There might perhaps be a dispensation for a father or a husband, but my father didn't come to the funeral. He was in Somalia, and nobody even thought about asking for a dispensation for me. So when I came, Hawea was already in the ground. I just sat in the squalid little room that my mother was now living in, on a filthy street in Eastleigh, and listened to her stories about living with Hawea for the past 6 months. I looked at the thin window bars, dented when Hawea threw herself at them, and the windows she had smashed, still broken. Ma and Hawea had lived here in this awful place. This was where they slept, cooked and washed. It was the most depressing room imaginable. Decades of charcoal fires stained the peeling walls. Ma told me how Hawea died. Her psychotic episodes had become much worse. Sometimes several men had to tie her down. Ma couldn't even go near her. A doctor came to give her injections and she seemed calmer. Then one night there was a thunderstorm. Hawea was standing at the window, watching the deluge. Suddenly she said she saw Allah in the lightning and ran out of the door. She ran barefoot into the road in the dark, sprinting across the potholes, and when Ma screamed for help, two Somali men ran after her. When they brought Hawea back, she was bleeding from her knees and from between her legs. She died a week after her miscarriage. I suppose it was an infection. I don't know if she even saw a doctor. I was speechless and horrified, and I was also frightened of my mother. It occurred to me that she might try to take away my passport and keep me in Nairobi. I went to sleep that night on the mattress that had been Hawea's, with my passport tied tightly around my waist. When Hawea died, I prayed. I robed and bowed for prayer as Ma told me to, for the sake of peace in the household. But those prayers were empty of content. More important, I sat by myself and begged Allah to give Hawea peace, because she had hell on earth. The idea that she was no longer in pain, but resting peacefully, was surprisingly comforting. My mother was bitter, a spent force. There was nothing left of the proud young woman who had left her family in the Miyi to go to Aden, who married the man of her choice and who struggled to save her family under dictatorship. Her dreams had turned into nightmares. My grandmother had left to go and live with my mother's youngest sister in Somalia. My mother was living in Eastleigh, a neighborhood she despised, in a country and a city she had always hated, and she was not on speaking terms with barely anyone in the community. Her family was no more. Mahat had disappointed her. One daughter had deserted her, and the other had gone mad, then become pregnant. That was my mother's worst nightmare come true. It was much worse than Hawea dying. On the afternoon of the next day, my mother began railing. "Why has Allah done this to me? How could your sister do this to me?" I couldn't bear that, hearing Hawea being blamed for hurting Ma. I thought of all the abuse, all the beatings my sister received when we were little. It didn't seem to occur to Ma that she might have had a role in what went wrong. I thought of how my mother had persuaded Hawea to leave her doctors and her medication in Holland and come back to Nairobi, to this ugly room, this utter squalor. I tried to sit Ma down and tell her this. I wanted to have a real conversation with her, perhaps the first in my life. But there was nothing left of the towering mother I remembered. Ma, not just thin now, she was worn, and I took pity on her. She was skin and bones. Her legs were open scabs from the psoriasis, and she was so unhappy. I had $1,000 with me, and I gave it to my mother. I said, I want you to get out of this room immediately. I'll send you the money. I want you to go to Somalia. Go to your brothers and sisters, your clan. There is nothing more in Nairobi. Hawea is gone, Mahad has no plans, and I won't be coming back here. You have no friends, you're fighting with everyone, you should leave. I felt I was the authority in the household now. I told Ma, I want you to go yourself to the grocery store, to pick up the money when it comes. I don't want Mahad to be involved. I told her how much money I had sent Mahad for her, easily over $10,000, which he had told me he was using to rent her a house in Westlands, and she came to life a bit with anger. I went to visit Halwa. She was still living in her father's house, still sleeping in the same bedroom, but it was as if a ghost had taken out her soul. A few months after I left Nairobi in 1992 to live with Osman Musa, Halwa was finally married to her cousin from Yemen. He ordered her around and expected her to serve him, though he was primitive and had never learned to read. Halwa hated her husband, but she became pregnant. When her daughter was born, she pleaded with her father to allow her to divorce. Her father reluctantly paid out a settlement, and Halwa's husband returned to Yemen. Now she hardly ever went out of her father's house. Her daughter was 4 years old. She was Halwa's only joy in life. The next day I went to visit Mahat's newborn son. I liked Sha'a, Mahat's young wife, very much. She seemed neglected. Mahat obviously wasn't spending much time with her. When I cornered Mahat, he said he was angry with Sha'a for getting pregnant. I asked if he had by any chance been using contraception, and he said no. Sha'a was supposed to count the days. I couldn't help it. I told Mahat how facile it was for him, a male, to always blame women for his problems. But when I saw him getting angry in return, I gritted my teeth to avoid another outburst. This wasn't the right time for that. Then I asked about the money I had sent him. Mahat told me he had invested it in a business, but the man absconded to Oman. As usual, he was the victim. I walked around. Nairobi was a shell of the city I had lived in. Roads were wrecked, telephones barely worked. The economy was in ruins. Such a huge increase in poverty in so short a time seemed obscene. Violence had become routine on the streets. Under Daniel Arap Moi, larceny and corruption on a truly massive scale was draining the whole country of any sense of energy and hope. Everything was chaos, and no one seemed to have any hope of making it better. It seemed like the end of the line. The night before I flew back to Holland, I couldn't sleep. I listened to the cars rumbling down the road in the early morning and realized I would never live here again. My life, or what I would make of it, would be in Holland now, for good. When I got back to Leiden after Hawea's funeral, I was an autopilot. My feelings had gone dead. I executed daily tasks and somehow got things done. Gradually, life took shape. I had missed several exams and papers, so I had work to do. Marco was very good to me. That helped. My old boyfriend, Abshir Abdi Aynab, the imam from Somalia, called me to express his condolences. He told me he was living in Switzerland and wanted to visit me. I brushed him off. I wanted nothing more to do with my old life. Chapter 14. Leaving God. I was becoming integrated into student society. And that society was nowhere near as predictable or as sedate as my circle in Ede. Geiske and my other friends in Leiden were either agnostics or atheists. Elroy, Marco's best friend, was homosexual. For example, Marco's friend Giovanni and his girlfriend Miriam broke up after Giovanni went to Israel to do biology research for 3 months, In his absence, Miriam fell in love with Olivia, one of Giovanni's friends. When Giovanni returned, he was upset. They had been together for years, but there was no honor killing, not even a hint of violence. Miriam had a perfect right to fall in love with someone else. Even her mother thought so, though she had adored Giovanni. I was fascinated by this vision of a completely different moral system. In May 1998, there were elections. Now that I was Dutch, I could vote. I gave it a lot of thought. Actually, to have the ability to choose the government of Holland, it felt like a momentous responsibility. I voted, like most of my friends, for Wim Kok from the Labour Party, a social democrat. My heart was on the left. I chose Kok because of his fairness and honesty, because he promised jobs and I believed him. He had experience and I liked his track record. Although I was a political science student working as a translator, it had not occurred to me yet to analyze any party's stance on immigration and integration. I was not yet questioning the government's role in why immigrants were so overrepresented in crime statistics, unemployment, and other social problems. In January 2000, the political commentator Paul Scheffer published an article, "The Multicultural Drama," in the NRC Handelsblad, a well-respected evening newspaper. It instantly became the talk of Holland. Everybody had an opinion about it. Scheffer said a new ethnic underclass of immigrants had formed, and it was much too insular, rejecting the values that knit together Dutch society and creating new damaging social divisions. There wasn't enough insistence on immigrants adapting. Teachers even questioned the relevance of teaching immigrant children Dutch history, and a whole generation of these children were being written off under a pretense of tolerance. Scheffer said there was no place in Holland for a culture that rejected the separation of church and state and denied rights to women and homosexuals. He foresaw social unrest. At the time, I poo-pooed Scheffer's concerns. To me, it seemed that the Dutch lived in an absolute paradise and tended to call any small problem a crisis. I thought of Holland in the 1990s as a country living through an embarrassment of riches, like its golden age in the 1600s. It was a trim little country where everybody was always nice, the economy was booming, trains arrived on time, although markedly less so since they had been privatized. Politics were collegial and even friendly. There were women and homosexuals in the cabinet, and everyone respected them enormously. I didn't believe the country could really have problems. To me, the words Scheffer used, crisis, social upheaval, seemed just newspaper chatter. In my final year, I had to focus on completing my thesis. I had chosen to examine the drift toward making law in the courts instead of in parliament. Politicians in Holland were failing to take responsibility and act decisively. Because they were so driven to seek consensus and electoral gains, they were letting judges take charge of issues that they deemed too controversial to touch. I thought I might go on to do a doctorate after I graduated and perhaps teach. In the spring of 2000, my father, by then almost blind from cataracts, managed to get a visa to go to Germany for an operation on his eyes, for which I gladly helped him pay. I visited him in Düsseldorf, driving all the way in my Peugeot 206 with Miriam. Marco and Ellen joined us a day later. Marco wanted badly to meet my father, and we agreed that Ellen and he should pretend to be a couple, because I wasn't ready to discuss with my father the fact that I was living in sin. Not yet. Abe embraced me. He looked much older, but he smelled exactly the same. It felt deeply good to be enfolded by him again. At first, we just talked about general things. What I was studying, politics. All my father wanted to talk about was Somalia, the great state Somalia could one day become. And he clearly said he wanted an Islamic government, a rule by Allah's laws. Any system of politics devised by man was bound to go wrong. I took the opposite stance. I surprised myself. I spoke sharply. I said divine law wouldn't be fair to everyone who wasn't Muslim, Even within Islam, not everyone thought the same way. Who would make the law? I told my father, the rule of clerics is totalitarian. It means people can't choose. Humanity is varied, and we should celebrate that instead of suppressing it. My father just said, we must all work hard to convert everyone to Islam. He disappointed me with his simple-minded logic and his depressing lack of realism. My father had decided to arrange for my divorce. I didn't feel the slightest bit married. Osman Musa was just a vague memory for me. But to my father it was vital. He told me that he shouldn't have obliged me to marry against my will. I should be free to choose the husband I wanted. I think he wanted to think of himself as someone who accorded freedom. There was still a Democrat buried inside him, after all. Abe told me he was sad to see changes in me. He said I was becoming too worldly, not spiritual enough. He said, I won't ask you to wear a headscarf, but please grow your hair. I told him I would, and I have. When he asked me if I still prayed, I said of course I did. In some sense, this was still true. I had all sorts of un-Muslim ideas, and yet, in those days, I did still think of myself as being in some larger, more important way a believer. When I graduated from Leiden in September 2000, I was almost 30 years old. It had taken me an extra year to get my master's degree, but I had made it. I told myself I should be proud. I had solid qualifications, a rocky but intimate relationship, and strong friendships. I was earning my own money. I had made myself a place in Holland with my own hands and legs and brain. I was thrilled to be graduating after so many years. I tried to get a visa for my father to attend the ceremony, but it was turned down. I phoned my mother to tell her I was getting my Master of Science degree. She made an awkward remark about how odd it was that it should be me, of her three children, who would graduate from the university. She probably meant no harm by it. In her eyes, I was still the dumbest of the three of us. Marco and I threw a party at the Café Einstein, which many Leiden students frequented. Johanna and Martin came from Ede with their kids, Irene and Jan, whom I adore as if they were my own little brother and sister. Martin climbed on a chair and started telling funny stories about what I was like when I first arrived. Geiske was the master of ceremonies, and Miriam's parents made lots of little hors d'oeuvres, which touched me hugely. When Miriam and Olivia walked in, I tensed, waiting for some dispute to break out with Giovanni. But Miriam hit it off perfectly with Giovanni's new girlfriend, Albertine. A whole group of people around me wished me well, but I also needed to think about what I was going to do next. I wanted to get a proper job and earn money so that Marco and I could afford a nicer apartment. I hated our dank council housing on the Lange Gracht, which gave me allergies. Before the Eid festival, some of our neighbors, who are Moroccan and Turkish, slaughtered sheep in the basement where we kept our bicycles. The entrails stayed in the trash for days before the garbage was picked up. It was like being in Eastleigh. There was noise at all hours. I wanted to get out of there, even though Marco said we couldn't afford it yet. He was so frugal, I complained. I couldn't see the point of waiting any longer than we had to. I decided against continuing my university studies. I could have gone on for a doctorate and received some kind of stipend as a teaching assistant, but that wasn't much better than minimum wage. It wouldn't get us out of the Lange Gracht or go far toward supporting my family in Africa. I would have to work. But I didn't want just to continue as a translator, which I saw as my student job, not a permanent career. I also wanted to gain more experience before shifting from being a student to research and teaching. I still had a great deal to learn, but I feared that in the private sector everyone would say I was too old for an entry-level job. I was so nervous about it that I took the first post I was offered with Glaxo, the pharmaceutical company. I had applied because Glaxo's business was helping people. Glaxo spent millions on AIDS and malaria research. By working there, I would somehow be participating. It was a big company. You came in on the sales force, but you could move and rise with time. The job came with a good starting salary, a company car, and 2 weeks of training that was like a crash course in medicine, with an emphasis on headaches and the respiratory system. It was also an education on how to sell things to people, which was a real eye-opener. I was supposed to sell Imigran, a migraine medication, to doctors. The Glaxo people taught us techniques to outwit doctor secretaries and get an appointment. They taught us to evaluate someone's personality type and pitch our sales techniques precisely to that kind of person, so that every appointment would get us a sale. If you sensed a doctor was the authoritarian type, you had to keep your pitch short and make it clear how clever you thought he was. You let him talk a lot, and then when you pitched the medication, you used the exact same words that he had. With analytical personalities, you didn't mention the medication at all at first. You went straight into a long discussion of all the different kinds of migraine headaches. It was manipulative, and to me a waste of doctor's precious time. So after a few weeks I gave back the car, the phone and the laptop. That was it for me and business. Next, I signed up at a temp agency, which sent me to work as an office manager in the housing department of the Oostgeest City Council. It was the same pleasant residential community outside Leiden where I had first lived with Chantal. I worked there for 2 or 3 months. I thought it would give me the opportunity to see government from within. For every application for a permit to build an attic or change a few windows, a whole group of people in this office had to work together. But they seemed to dislike each other. There were more civil servants than there were tasks to do, and they spent their days bickering. Every permit had to be countersigned by directors and directors of the directors, and everything was unbelievably slow. I had applied for a job at the Interior Ministry a year before, and it had taken 6 months to process my application. Now, friends who worked in government ministries confirmed that government work was slow, with no imagination or satisfaction. So I ruled out government. I didn't want to work in the civil service for the rest of my life. I began looking around with a sense of growing panic for what I was going to do. One morning in March, Marco looked up from the newspaper and crowed, "This job's perfect for you. Your name is written all over it." He showed me the ad. The V.I.D. Beckman Institute, the research bureau of Wim Kok's Labour Party, was looking for a junior researcher. It paid less than Glaxo, but it was only 4 days a week, and I could translate the rest of the time to supplement my income. More important, it sounded truly interesting. I would be researching issues that were politically and socially relevant for a party to which I already belonged. A think tank would not be bureaucratic at all. It would be small, intellectually agile, challenging. The V.I.D. Beckman Institute offered me the job in June 2001. I was thrilled. I was supposed to start work the 1st of September. I instantly quit the city council job and went back to translating. This earned me much more money, which Marco and I would need to buy a house. I was determined to find us another place to live, and at first Marco went along with me. But whenever I found somewhere I liked, Marco would balk, claiming it was too expensive or too far away from the center of town for him. Marco didn't want to move, didn't want to be ensnared in a huge bank loan. He wanted to spend all his spare cash on roaming the world. I thought that was immature. He said I was too impatient and a spendthrift. Our relationship was deteriorating. We had been fighting for years over small, stupid things. Time management and household expenses. He needed to plan everything. I hated that constriction. He had a temper. I had never liked yelling or being yelled at. I had already started thinking about breaking up when I saw a perfect, if round-down house on a tree-lined street close to the train station with wooden floors and fireplaces. Marco said renovating it would cost too much. I decided to buy the house anyway, without Marco. We could still be friends. Maybe he could still be my boyfriend, but it was time for me to move out before things got any worse between us. Ellen had split up with her husband, Badal Zadeh, and after a certain amount of soul-searching, she agreed to come and live in Leiden and share the house and mortgage with me. We went to the bank. Both of us earned good money. In April, Ellen and I moved in together. One evening we were watching TV when an item came on about gay school teachers being harassed by Moroccan kids. This sort of thing was often in the news in those days. You would open the newspaper and think, what, Moroccan boys again? What's wrong with them? So when an imam came on, wearing traditional clothes and with the imam manner about him, speaking Arabic, I turned up the volume. He looked at the camera with great authority and explained that homosexuality was a contagious disease that could infect school children. It was, he said, a threat to humanity. I remember standing up and saying, this is so backward. He is so stupid. To the Somali in me, this attitude was familiar, but the Dutch person in me was shocked. The interview caused a commotion, and I sat down and wrote an article and sent it to the NRC Handelsblad. I wrote that this attitude was much larger than just one imam. It was systemic in Islam. Because this was a religion that had never gone through a process of enlightenment that would lead people to question its rigid approach to individual freedom. Moreover, I wrote, Islam didn't oppose only the right of homosexuals to live undisturbed. Anyone who had been to an abortion clinic or a women's center could readily see that the sexual morals of Islam can only lead to suffering. It was spontaneous indignation. I found myself discovering my opinions as I typed. The article was edited into a short letter, couched in nice, politically correct language, and was published in May. But that was my political coming out. Ellen and I spent 2 months fixing up the house. Then I settled back to enjoy life. We had dinner parties. Ellen was going through a period of religious turmoil, looking for her bearings, and she talked about which church she should join. Even Marco and I were getting along very well. We considered getting back together again. It was a summer of cooking for people, independence, a happy time. On September 3, I started work. The Labour Party's think tank was a small office, and I was just a junior researcher. My first task was to work on immigration, which I was beginning to see as the most important question facing Holland in the 21st century. I wasn't looking at Islam as a central question yet, but studying migration, its causes, and the implications for a welfare state of absorbing all these new migrants. Should the Labour Party support more restrictive policies on immigration? Holland wanted to keep its welfare state, but it clearly could not afford to offer its benefits to the whole world. They had to have some kind of restrictions on entry. The question was, what? I planned to arrange a discussion among experts and organize their papers into a book. I was not writing policy, but I was required to nurture and expand the think tank's network of experts and do research for them. They would deliver a roadmap on how to deal with the question. How did other countries manage immigration? And how much migration could a welfare state absorb and still remain a welfare state? One afternoon, in my second week of working at the Labour Party, I was reading old reports when a commotion erupted downstairs. I walked down to see what could be making so much noise, determined to tell these people to be quiet. A clump of people huddled around the TV, which was tuned to CNN. I sighed. In those days, I was prejudiced against America and the American media. At Leiden, I had even written a paper on media hype using the Monica Lewinsky debacle as an example. During Bill Clinton's impeachment attempt, CNN had constantly reported live with breaking news on completely trivial aspects of Clinton's sex life. The holier-than-thou manner of Kenneth Starr, Clinton's nemesis, always reminded me disagreeably of Ichabo. Simply by devoting so much attention to this issue, the media had made it seem important, and the whole episode left me with the impression that Americans were hysterical. So when I saw the breaking news banner that afternoon, I thought CNN had unearthed another minor event to bang its drum about. But as I stood there, the second plane hit the World Trade Center. The anchorwoman was saying that it might not be an accident, that the two crashes might be a deliberate attack. Again and again we watched the horrific footage of planes hitting the towers. I found myself screwing my eyes tight shut and thinking in Somali, "Oh Allah, please let it not be Muslims who did this." I knew this could ignite a major world conflict. When I got home from work, I told Ellen, "The Americans are going to retaliate. They are not like the Dutch. They are not going to say, 'Let's sit down and talk about this.' It will be the Third World War." Ellen told me not to get so overwrought. But that night we saw news footage that shocked me further. In Holland itself, in Ede, in the town I had lived in, a camera crew who happened to be filming on the streets just after the towers were hit recorded a group of Muslim kids jubilating. All of Holland was shaken by that, but I was far more frightened than most. Ellen kept telling me, "They were just kids. It's been overblown. If the cameras hadn't been there, it wouldn't have happened." But I knew inside that the cameras just caught a part of it. If there had been more cameras in other neighborhoods, they would have seen it there too. The morning after the 9/11 attacks, after getting off my commuter train, I found myself walking to the office with Ruud Kouwler, the chairman of the Labour Party. Ruud had been one of my teachers at Leiden. He greeted me by my first name. There isn't much hierarchy in Holland, and like everyone in the world, we began talking about the Twin Towers attack. Ruud shook his head sadly about it all. He said, "It's so weird, isn't it, all these people saying this has to do with Islam?" I couldn't help myself. Just before we reached the office, I blurted out, "But it is about Islam. This is based in belief. This is Islam." Ruud said, "Ayaan, of course these people may have been Muslims, but they are a lunatic fringe. We have extremist Christians too, who interpret the Bible literally. Most Muslims do not believe these things. To say so is to disparage a faith which is the second largest religion in the world and which is civilized and peaceful." I walked into the office thinking, I have to wake these people up. It wasn't just Kola by any means. Holland, this fortunate country where nothing ever happens, was trying to pretend nothing had happened again. The Dutch had forgotten that it was possible for people to stand up and wage war, destroy property, imprison, kill, impose laws of virtue because of the call of God. That kind of religion hadn't been present in Holland for centuries. It was not a lunatic fringe who felt this way about America and the West. I knew that a vast mass of Muslims would see the attacks as justified retaliation against the infidel enemies of Islam. War had been declared in the name of Islam, my religion, and now I had to make a choice. Which side was I on? I found I couldn't avoid the question. Was this really Islam? Did Islam permit, even call for, this kind of slaughter? Did I, as a Muslim, approve of the attack? And if I didn't, where did I stand on Islam? I walked around with these questions for weeks. I couldn't get them out of my head. I became fixated on the 9/11 attacks. I combed through newspapers, searched the internet. I saw how many demonstrations around the world took place, actively in open support of Osama bin Laden. In northern Nigeria, hundreds of people were killed in communal riots. World leaders hurried to television stations calling on Muslims to condemn the attacks. There seemed to be a huge appeal to the morals of Islam. All sorts of articles called on Muslims to stand up and say that Islam does not permit this sort of slaughter of non-combatants. When I read them, I felt as though these articles were talking to me. Muhammad Atta, the hijackers' leader, had instructed them on how to die as a good Muslim. He used the prayer every Muslim utters when he's dying. He asks Allah to stand by him as he comes to him. I read it and I recognized it. Everything about the tone and substance of that letter was familiar to me. This was not just Islam, this was the core of Islam. Muhammad Atta believed that he was giving his life for Allah. Muhammad Atta was exactly my age. I felt as though I knew him, and in fact I did know many people just like him. The people in the debating center I had attended in Nairobi, for example, they would have written that letter if they had had the courage to do what Atta did. If I had remained with them, Perhaps I could have done it. Or perhaps Ichabo would have. There were tens of thousands of people in Africa, the Middle East, even in Holland, who thought this way. Every devout Muslim who aspired to practice genuine Islam, the Muslim Brotherhood Islam, the Islam of the Medina Quran schools, even if they didn't actively support the attacks, they must at least have approved of them. This wasn't just a band of frustrated Egyptian architects in Hamburg. It was much bigger than that, and it had nothing to do with frustration. It was about belief. Infuriatingly stupid analysts, especially people who called themselves Arabists, yet who seemed to know next to nothing about the reality of the Islamic world, wrote reams of commentary. Their articles were all about Islam saving Aristotle and the Zero, which medieval Muslim scholars had done more than 800 years ago, about Islam being a religion of peace and tolerance, not the slightest bit violent. These were fairy tales, nothing to do with the real world I knew. Everything in the newspapers was, yes, but. Yes, it's terrible to kill people, but. People theorized beautifully about poverty pushing people to terrorism, about colonialism and consumerism, pop culture and Western decadence eating away at people's culture and therefore causing the carnage. But Africa is the poorest continent I knew, and poverty doesn't cause terrorism. Truly, poor people can't look farther than their next meal, and more intellectual people are usually angry at their own governments. They flock to the West. I read rants by anti-racist bureaus claiming that a terrible wave of Islamophobia had been unleashed in Holland, that Holland's inner racist attitude was now apparent. None of this pseudo-intellectualizing had anything to do with reality. Other articles blamed the Americans' blind support for Israel and opined that there would be more 9/11s until the Israeli-Palestinian conflict was resolved. I didn't completely believe this either. I myself, as a teenager, might have cheered the World Trade Center and Pentagon attacks, and the Palestinian dispute was completely abstract to me in Nairobi. If the hijackers had been 19 Palestinian men, then I might have given this argument more weight, but they weren't. None of them was poor. None of them left a letter saying there would be more attacks until Palestine was liberated. This was belief, I thought, not frustration, poverty, colonialism, or Israel. It was about religious belief, a one-way ticket to heaven. Most articles analyzing bin Laden and his movement were scrutinizing a symptom, a little like analyzing Lenin and Stalin without looking at the works of Karl Marx. The Prophet Muhammad was the moral guide, not bin Laden, and it was the Prophet's guidance that should be evaluated. But what if I didn't like the outcome of that analysis? What would I do then? Videotapes of old interviews with Osama bin Laden began running on CNN and Al Jazeera. They were filled with justification for total war on America, which, together with the Jews, he perceived as leading a new crusade on Islam. Sitting in a dainty house in picture-perfect Leiden, I thought it sounded far-fetched, like the ravings of a madman. But bin Laden's quotes from the Quran resonated in my brain. When you meet the unbelievers, strike them in the neck. If you do not go out and fight, God will punish you severely and put others in your place. Wherever you find the polytheists, kill them, seize them, besiege them, ambush them. You who believe, do not take the Jews and Christians as friends. They are allies only to each other. Anyone who takes them as an ally becomes one of them. Bin Laden quoted the hadith. The hour of judgment will not come until the Muslims fight the Jews and kill them. I didn't want to do it, but I had to. I picked up the Quran and the hadith and started looking through them to check. I hated to do it because I knew that I would find bin Laden's quotations in there, and I didn't want to question God's word. But I needed to ask, did the 9/11 attacks stem from true belief in true Islam? And if so, what did I think about Islam? Osama bin Laden said, either you are with the crusade or you are with Islam. And I felt that Islam all over the world was now in a truly terrible crisis. Surely no Muslim could continue to ignore the clash between reason and our religion. For centuries we had been behaving as though all knowledge was in the Quran, refusing to question anything, refusing to progress. We had been hiding from prison for so long because we were incapable of facing up to the need to integrate it into our beliefs. And this was not working. It was leading to hideous pain and monstrous behavior. We Muslims had been taught to define life on earth as a passage, a test that precedes real life in the hereafter. In that test, everyone should ideally live in a manner resembling as closely as possible the followers of the Prophet. Didn't this inhibit investment in improving daily life? Was innovation therefore forbidden to Muslims? Why human rights progress, women's rights all foreign to Islam? By declaring our Prophet infallible and not permitting ourselves to question him, we Muslims had set up a static tyranny. The Prophet Muhammad attempted to legislate every aspect of life. By adhering to his rules of what is permitted and what is forbidden, we Muslims suppressed the freedom to think for ourselves and to act as we chose. We froze the moral outlook of billions of people into the mindset of the Arab desert in the 7th century. We were not just servants of Allah, we were slaves. The little shutter at the back of my mind, where I pushed all my dissonant thoughts, snapped open after the 9/11 attacks, and it refused to close again. I found myself thinking that the Quran is not a holy document. It's a historical record written by humans. It is one version of events as perceived by the men who wrote it 150 years after the Prophet Muhammad died. And it's a very tribal and Arab version of events. It spreads a culture that is brutal, bigoted, fixated on controlling women, and harsh in war. The Prophet did teach us a lot of good things. I found it spiritually appealing to believe in a hereafter. My life was enriched by the Quranic injunctions to be compassionate and show charity to others. There were times when I, like many other Muslims, found it too complicated to deal with the whole issue of war against the unbelievers. Most Muslims never delve into theology, and we rarely read the Quran. We are taught it in Arabic, which most Muslims can't speak. As a result, most people think that Islam is about peace. It is from these people, honest and kind, that the fallacy has arisen that Islam is peaceful and tolerant. But I could no longer avoid seeing the totalitarianism, the pure moral framework that is Islam. It regulates every detail of life and subjugates free will. True Islam, as a rigid belief system and a moral framework, leads to cruelty. The inhuman act of those 19 hijackers was the logical outcome of this detailed system for regulating human behavior. Their world is divided between us and them. If you don't accept Islam, you should perish. It didn't have to be this way. The West underwent a period of religious warfare and persecution, but then society freed itself from the grip of violent organized religion. I still assume, that the same process could occur among the millions of Muslims. We Muslims could shed our attachment to those dogmas that clearly lead to ignorance and oppression. In fact, I thought we were lucky. There were now so many books that Muslims could read them and leapfrog the Enlightenment, just as the Japanese have done. We could hold our dogmas up to the light, scrutinize them, and then infuse traditions that are rigid and humane with the values of progress and modernity. We could come to terms with individual expression. For me to think this way, of course, I had to make the leap to believing that the Quran was relative, not absolute, not the literal syllables pronounced by God, but just another book. I also had to reject the idea of hell, whose looming prospect had always frightened me from making any criticism of Islam. I found myself thinking one night, but if that is so, then what do I believe truly about God? Around this time, Abshir, the young imam from Somalia, once again contacted me. He had been living in Switzerland for some years and had just been hospitalized. He was set to undergo heart surgery the next day. We talked about September 11, of course. I told Abshir, all these statements that bin Laden and his people quote from the Quran to justify the attacks, I looked them up. They are there. If the Quran is timeless, then it applies to every Muslim today. This is how Muslims may behave if they are at war with infidels. It isn't just about the battles of Uhud and Badr in the 7th century. Abshir said, "You are right, and I'm just as confused as you. I'm being operated on my heart, but it's my head that's hurting." He told me he had begun attending talks on Islam in Geneva by the French Islamic philosopher Tariq Ramadan. Ramadan is the grandson of Hassan al-Banna, who founded the Muslim Brotherhood. After these talks, Abshir said, "I find I'm even more confused. He talks in circles. He says things like, 'The Prophet has declared Islam is peace, therefore it's peace.'" I said, "Yes, but those verses about peace in the Quran apply only to life among the Muslims. The Prophet also said, 'Wage war on the unbelievers.' Who are the unbelievers, and who gives the signal to wage war?" "It's certainly not Bin Laden who's the authority," Abshir said. "We can't wage war against a whole hemisphere where Muslims aren't in control." I broke in, "Abshir, if we say the Quran is not timeless, then it's not holy, is it?" He said, "What are you talking about?" I told him, "I'm sorry, but I think I'm on the brink of becoming an apostate. I'm finding it more and more difficult to believe." There was silence on the other end of the phone. Then Abshir said, "This thing has confused us all. You're living with a lot of stress. It's always difficult to maintain perspective in the context of a non-Islamic country. Give yourself a break. Take some time off. You need to get back in touch with our family, with our kinsmen. You are too isolated from the Osman Mahmud. Ayan, if you think about this, you'll risk hell." I said, "But if I am questioning the holiness of the Quran, that means I also question the existence of hell and heaven." Abshir said, "That's impossible." I told him, "It's not just that. All these angels and jinns, I may be very underdeveloped in my understanding of the exact sciences, but I still see no proof of their existence. Abshir, looking at the paintings here in the West, are these the angels, beings in white dresses with chubby cheeks?" Abshir said, "No, Muslim angels are totally different. They don't have wings." I said, "You know, I am now going to ask you what they look like, and you will tell me you don't know because Allah reveals things in His time." Abshir said, "I love you. I too am confused. This has had a huge impact on all of us. Please don't do this, Ayan. Give yourself a break." I wished him lots of luck and the moral strength to find a way out of this dilemma. Abshir was intelligent, compassionate, and generous, but he was scared. Scared of the angel who would visit him after he died to interrogate him on his loyalty to Allah and the Prophet. He was scared of failing that exam and of the endless hellfire that would await him. We hung up awkwardly. I knew I wouldn't be talking to him again. In November 2001, I attended a debate at the Bali, a discussion house in Amsterdam. It was organized by Letter and Spirit, the review section of the newspaper Trouw, which was run by two men, Jaffa Fink and Chris Rutherfrans, and was fast becoming something of a forum for discussion of the relationship between Islam and the West. Letter and Spirit published all kinds of articles by people who didn't necessarily share the mainstream view that Islam was a peaceful, Aristotle-rescuing movement. At the Bali, the discussion was entitled, "The West or Islam? Who needs a Voltaire?" The speakers, one after another, supported the premise that another Voltaire is needed in the West. They pointed out everything that is wrong with the West, the arrogance of invading other countries, and neo-colonialism, and the decadence of a system that had created societies that only consume, and so on. It was the usual. Then came Afshin Elian from Iran, a professor of penal law at Amsterdam University, who eloquently proposed that Islam needed critical renewal. It was time for general debate in the audience. Most people seemed to agree with the speakers who had criticized the West in some aspect or other. I decided to speak. I raised my hand for the microphone and said, "Look at how many Voltaires the West has. Don't deny us the right to have our Voltaire too. Look at our women and look at our countries. Look at how we are all fleeing and asking for refuge here, and how people are now flying planes into buildings in their madness. Allow us a Voltaire, because we are truly living in the Dark Ages. When I finished, the room was full of raised hands, many of them Muslim. This was Amsterdam. Lots of people attend these talks, so their presence at this debate was natural. But almost all of them seemed very angry with me and Afshin Elian. They went on about Averroes and saving Aristotle, and how Islam discovered the zero and so on. It was irritating. So what has happened in Islamic civilization since the year 1200? But I couldn't just take charge of the microphone. I could only roll my eyes and curl my lip. When the debate ended, Afshin came up to me and said, "You are a little Voltaire yourself. Where did you spring from?" I said, "I'm from Somalia." And Afshin said, "I just know our Muslim civilization will be saved by a woman." He was very nice. He was a refugee himself. While we were talking, Chris Rutherfrans, one of the editors of the Trial Supplement, came up to us. He introduced himself and said to me, "Why don't you write us an article about these ideas, just as you said them here?" I said I would be delighted, and in the next few days, I worked furiously. But I was not allowed to publish articles without showing them to my boss at the Weadi Beckman office, because the newspaper would identify me as a researcher there. A few days later, I showed my draft of the article to my director, Paul Kalmer. He was annoyed. We were a think tank, we were paid to think, and of course he was in favor of freedom of expression, he told me, but I couldn't possibly say such things. It would harm the Labour Party. Even if I signed it with just my name, no affiliation to the Institute at all, the minute a Muslim published such an article, all racists and Islamophobes would seize on it. I told Paul, "That's not relevant, because when something is true, it is true." But it was a sensitive time in Dutch politics. Pim Fortuyn, a complete unknown in Dutch politics, had begun a meteoric rise in popularity on the basis of his accurate observation that ethnic minorities didn't sufficiently espouse Dutch values. Fortuyn pointed out that Muslims would soon be the majority in most of Holland's major cities. He said they mostly failed to accept the rights of women and homosexuals, as well as the basic principles that underlie democracy. Rather than dealing forthrightly with the issues that Fortuyn raised, the Labour Party had basically decided to avoid them. Paul Kalmer was honest and a good person. There was a lot of affection between us. He was seeking to protect me, to prevent me from pandering to racists by voicing right-wing views. So he edited my article until he was comfortable that potential racists would not be able to abuse it. In those days, especially in Labour Party circles, people were always positive about Islam. If Muslims wanted mosques and separate graveyards and ritual slaughterhouses, such things were built. Community centres were provided. Islamic fundamentalist ideas were swelling in such centres, but Labour Party people usually dismissed this as a natural reaction. These immigrants had been uprooted, they said. They were clinging, temporarily, to traditional ideas, which would gradually fade away. They forgot how long it had taken Europe to shake off obscurantism and intolerance, and how difficult that struggle was. When Somalis told me they didn't want to live in Galo neighbourhoods, I knew they wanted to avoid contact with the ungodliness of Holland. But Dutch officials always saw it as a natural desire to form a community. When Muslims wanted their own school, I saw it as forcing children to obey ideas unquestioningly. The Dutch saw no harm in funding them. When satellite dishes began bristling from every apartment in municipal housing projects, tuned to Morocco and Turkish TV, my Labour Party colleagues saw this as a natural desire to maintain contact with home. But with the dishes came preaching, indoctrination. There were door-to-door preachers passing out cassettes in most Dutch cities, just like Bokkelsom did in Eastleigh. Most migrant neighbourhoods had shops selling traditional clothes and carpets and tapes, DVDs and books on how to be a good Muslim in infidel territory. When the number of women wearing headscarves on the street became impossible to ignore, my Labour Party colleagues thought it was only recent immigrants who would soon abandon the practice. They failed to realise that it was the second generation who were rediscovering their roots, quote-unquote, brainwashed by a jargon I recognized. Tawhid, Kufr, the evil Jews. After my article was published, I received dozens of letters from readers applauding me. How wonderful that someone like you exists. Have you heard of Spinoza? I received an invitation to speak at a symposium on Spinoza at the Thomas Mann Institute. I went back to my enlightened textbooks and read about Spinoza and figured people were probably connecting us because we were both refugees. Spinoza's family emigrated to Holland in the 1600s to flee the Inquisition in Portugal. I received several other invitations to speak, one of which was in the little Dutch city of Hengelo. They invited me to give their 50th annual Freedom and Human Rights speech in December. The title of the evening was, Should We Fear Islam? I told Paul Kalmer about it, and he said, What is your answer? I said, Well, it's yes and no. And he said, Fine, I should attend. I was nervous. I had never written a speech before. I showed what I had written to Chris Rutherfrans from Trau. He wanted to publish it. I asked him to let me give the speech first. But when I asked Paul for permission and showed him what I had said, he went scarlet. He told me I was personally attacking the Minister for Integration and even the Mayor of Amsterdam, Job Cohen, who was prominent in our own Labour Party. Actually, my intent was more like teasing them for being so silly as to think that Muslims would integrate best if the Dutch indulged every kind of Muslim self-segregation. Paul said he had a duty to protect me from writing this right-wing stuff. Everything I wrote about Islam turned out to be much more sensitive than any other topic I could have chosen to write about. I changed a couple of terms. I was learning that in these extremely civilized circles, conflict is dealt with in a very ornate and hypocritical manner. When I told Chris Rutherfrans I had another draft, he realized right away that my boss had advised me to tone it down. He called Paul and they had a shouting match. The next weekend, the revised article appeared in Trouw. But a week later, Jeffa Fink, Rutherfrans's co-editor at The Supplement, wrote an article about the quarrel. He quoted all the material that Paul made me remove, such as comparing Job Cohen to an Ayatollah. 2 days later, there was a board meeting at the Viadi Beckman Institute, with Job Cohen himself and my article, and Fink's piece in Trouw was on the agenda. I just kept quiet. Paul Kalmer told the board, Ayan is just starting out. She's sharp, but she shouldn't have gone so far. Cohen asked him, This description of your quarrel in Trouw, is it true? Paul said, Of course, I didn't want her to write this sort of personal attack. We are members of the same party. A conflict of opinion should be solved behind closed doors, not in a newspaper. Cohen snapped. If she wants to write it, she should write it. I don't mind in the least being called an Ayatollah. What I mind is censorship. He looked at me and said, I've read what you said, and I want the opportunity to say I don't agree with you. This is an institute for thought. As long as it's well argued, you should be able to write what you want. He blew me away with his open-mindedness. Cohen went on to say that the Labour Party needed more thinking about these subjects. He had been the junior minister for migration policy, and he said immigration wasn't so much the issue. People should be focusing now on the shocking deficit in integrating the children and grandchildren of immigrants into Dutch society. He said, Ayan, why don't you look into that for us? I thought he was a hero. I began reading everything I could lay my hands on about immigration and integration. Basically, I saw the problem as similar to those of the Mi'i, the rural poor lands, being brought to the city. European societies with their thrilling technology, easy money, and bright lights were decadent and tempting and unassailable, their cords a cipher. The question was how to adapt. In February, I attended a conference on Islam in Europe held by the European Social Democrat parties in Granada, Spain. All present seemed to think it would be easy to set up the institutions for a European Islam in peace and harmony. They seemed clouded by wishful thinking rather than operating with rigorous analysis. A tiny community of so-called experts on immigration in Europe had been quoting each other for decades, it appeared. They shared an approach that was essentially socio-economic. I thought we also needed a broader cultural analysis of immigrant integration. In the past, Dutch social democrats had blamed the Catholic Church for keeping people poor and ignorant. I was only a junior researcher, but I thought to myself, when are they going to look at Islam? Surely, Islam was some kind of influence in the underperforming segregation of so many immigrants in Holland. As I went on doing research, it became painfully apparent that of all the non-Western immigrants in Holland, the least integrated are Muslims. Among immigrants, unemployment is highest for Moroccans and Turks, the largest Muslim groups, although their average level of skills is roughly the same as all the other immigrant populations. Taken as a whole, Muslims in Holland make disproportionately heavy claims on social welfare and disability benefits and are disproportionately involved in crime. If Muslim immigrants lagged so far behind even other immigrant groups, then wasn't it possible that one of the reasons could be Islam? Islam influences every aspect of believers' lives.